Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Growing up in the 1960s, it was impossible not to notice the space program. But I didn't just notice it, I was obsessed by it. I watched every mission from launch to splashdown and talked my sister into taking me to the Kennedy Space Center in 1967. And the Apollo astronauts were, to me, way bigger than any pro sports athletes, movie stars, and maybe even the Beatles. I knew all their names and built models of their spacecraft, and I wasn't alone. There were a lot of kids like me back then, and some of them went on to actually do some amazing things with their love of the space program. Like Andy Chaikin, who we'll hear from in our next program. He wrote the definitive book about Project Apollo, A Man on the Moon, which was published in 1994 and used by Tom Hanks as his Bible for producing the HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon. And Hanks, of course, famously played Jim Lovell in the movie Apollo 13. Through the years, I have had the good fortune to meet and interview many people associated with the Apollo program, and one of my favorite astronauts has always been Alan Bean. I only met him briefly, but he made such an impression on me. So I want to share what this very special man was like with all of us through the experiences of those who knew him really well. We'll talk to Apollo astronauts Walt Cunningham and Rusty Schweikart, who were especially close with Al Bean, and Space Shuttle-era astronaut Karen Nyberg, who was befriended by Bean as they shared their love of art and flying in space. Andy Chaikin will join us in the next program to tell us about his amazing experiences chronicling the flight of Apollo 12, which also became part of a lifelong friendship with the astronaut. Apollo 12 was the second lunar landing mission, launched on November 14, 1969. It was a cloudy morning at the Cape, but no lightning had been detected in the immediate area, so the countdown proceeded.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engines running, commit, liftoff. We have liftoff, 11:22 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
The Saturn V lifted off magnificently and began to roll into its proper heading when suddenly Commander Pete Conrad saw a flash of light outside.
Okay, we just lost the platform, gang. I don't know what happened here. We had everything in the world drop out.
Roger.
I got 3 fuel cell lights, an AC bus light, a fuel cell disconnect, AC bus overload 1 and 2, main bus A and B out.
Every alarm and warning light dealing with the spacecraft's electrical system began glowing brightly. Something had gone terribly wrong. And it had. The rocket had generated its own conducting vapor trail that acted like a giant lightning rod.
Apollo 12 Houston, try FCE to auxiliary, over.
NCE to auxiliary.
FCE, FCE to auxiliary.
Notice that Conrad doesn't seem quite sure what the switch is, but Alan Bean did. Now listen to Conrad describe what has happened. And notice that he says it was Alan Bean who reset the fuel cells, because Bean knew exactly what that switch was. It was his job, and he was well prepared to do it.
Your thrust is looking good, Bean.
Okay, I have a good GDC, and Al has got the fuel cells back on, and we'll be working on our AC buses.
Right, Pete, your fuel cells look good down here.
I think we need to do a little more all-weather testing.
Amen.
I don't know about you, but I think if I knew my spacecraft had been hit by lightning, I'd be pretty freaked out. But then again, I don't think I ever would have had the courage to get on top of one of those giant rockets to begin with. That's what made the astronauts a breed apart. The guys with, as the late Tom Wolfe put it, the right stuff. Well, let's meet one of them now. Astronaut Walt Cunningham flew on Apollo 7 in October of 1968. It was the first flight of the redesigned Apollo Command and Service Modules after the tragic fire that killed astronauts Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee in January of 1967. Walt and Al Bean were very close friends throughout their time at NASA and beyond. Walt joined us from his home in Houston, not far from the Bean residence. Walt Cunningham, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here, although it's a sad topic to be talking about.
Yes, it is. And I really, my deepest condolences to you as his friend. And I really do want you to know we appreciate your time talking about this.
No problem. Actually, Alan Bean and I have been friends for 55 years, and he is one day older than me.
Wow. I'd like to first just give people a sense of, you know, who you are. You flew on Apollo 7, which was, you were a member of the first crew to ever fly on an Apollo spacecraft. And was that the longest flight of an Apollo spacecraft, too?
Well, actually, it was for a couple of years, but the last landing, maybe the last two landings on the moon, I think they may have gone a day farther. But for the longest time, we were. And also, Apollo 7 was the longest, the most ambitious, the most successful first test flight of any new flying machine ever.
Wow. And that was in October of 1968.
In October 11th to 22nd, 1968. And you can see that was almost 11 days.
I'd like to get a sense of your colleagues and Al Bean. Tell us a little bit about the third class of astronauts that you were in.
Well, the third class of astronauts was it was significant in two ways. And one is how different it is today than what it was then. Secondly, it was the first group of the three groups. It was the first group that had knocked off the requirement that you had to be working as a test pilot. And so there were many of us. Everybody was a fighter pilot, and many of us thought of ourselves as a test pilot, even though we hadn't been through test pilot school. But I think of our group of 14 that they selected in October of 1968, they selected us in the fall of 1962. There was about half of us that had not gone to test pilot school.
One of the stories about your group that I always found humorous, and I wondered if you briefly share it with us. When you guys checked into a hotel there in Houston, you all checked in under the same name. Is that right?
Well, it is kind of interesting as we slowly learned how the business was being run there. But when we showed up for the announcement of the third group of astronauts in a press conference, we were all checking into the Rice Hotel. And after we sat down and chatted a little bit, we found out that we had all checked in under the same false name. And his name was Hooper. He was the managing, and not the director, but the manager of the hotel at that time. And we were all signing in under his name.
I thought his name was Max Peck.
You're right. It was Max Peck. And eventually became friends. But as I got older now, I could see that I forgot Max's name.
I just thought that was the name just struck me as the whole thing was kind of humorous with you guys all checking in as saying, yeah, my name's Max Peck, and them checking you in.
They didn't want to have the notoriousness of the new astronauts. At that time, we just doubled the number of astronauts. We'd gone from the first groups were 7 to 9, that's 16, and our group was 14, so it almost doubled it. And we didn't select any for a couple of years after that. So it was from the perspective we were all military fighter pilots, and most of them were also test pilots.
And tell me about how you first got to know Al Bean. When did you really start to form a friendship with him?
Al Bean and I, you can tell by the names, that when we sat down for the panel for the interview with the public for the first time there, Bean and Cunningham, right next to each other, and we lived about, maybe 2.5-3 blocks apart. We had the same kind of interests. He was a Navy fighter pilot. I'd been through Navy Fighter Pilot School, but had taken my commission in the Marine Corps. So, and we were also by comparison with a lot of the other guys there that had been there a long time, we would be considered kind of square. We weren't quite as wild and crazy as a lot of the test pilots.
And you lived near him all of your lives since then, right?
Yeah, yes, we have. From that time we were down there, we lived within a couple blocks of each other, and for at least the last 20 or 30 years since we've both left NASA, we've been living a couple different places, but the max we've ever been apart is about 5 miles, and so that's where Alan and I, even today, Alan's wife Leslie is there, and we're here less than 5 miles apart, and Alan and I saw each other not every day, but at least once a month, because we would always have a cheeseburger together at least once a month, every month. And since Alan was born on the 15th, an odd-numbered day, and when it was an odd-numbered month, he paid for the bill. When it was an even-numbered month, I paid for the bill.
I'd like to ask you about something that I read in your book, The All-American Boys. You went through a process of peer ranking everyone in your group. There were 14 of you astronauts that you were asked to peer rank without including yourself. And I found it very instructive who you put as number one. Would you tell us who that was and why you put him there?
Well, that was Alan Bean was number one on my list, if I remember it right.
Yeah.
That's been a long time ago, and it's kind of strange. I tried to be as objective as I could about it, and because Alan had impressed me a lot that way. But it turns out he was one of the last of our group, I think, to finally fly, for whatever reasons that went on like that. But I did have, like, the order. If you looked at my list of 13, in the order of it, I guess I had not too many errors in the first 5 or 6. They flew in that order that I had on that list.
Yeah, and of course he flew on Apollo 12 and was the fourth man to walk on the moon in November 1969.
That's right. He had an outstanding career, and it is kind of probably unusual for the outside to see it this way, but you didn't have to necessarily start in front to end up with the right kind of career, because a lot of things changed. And missions changed. If somebody had an accident, or somebody could have died, or somebody could have had a plane crash, and then that recycled the people who were in there, and it worked out, very, very good.
Yeah, and there were a few members of your group, as I recall, that died in plane crashes, weren't there?
Well, yes, we lost several, I would have to say that in general they tended to have a pretty good factor of pilot error, because we were pushing ourselves all the time. We didn't think of ourselves that way, but that's the way it is. If you are a serious fighter pilot or even a test pilot, you're used to sticking your neck out, and you've got self-confidence that enables you to overcome a lot of things that some other people might not be able to do. So we ended up losing, we lost the 3 in the Apollo 1 fire. We also lost, by that time we'd lost 2 more in pilot accidents, which was it was a little bit surprising and shocking to me, because I was surprised that they had not been able to save themselves. Well, one case was not, because Ted Freeman he was in the landing pattern when he hit a bird. A bird hit the cockpit, and he went out of it. And the other Marine he had an accident coming back from the Cape. It was kind of a shock. And as I look back on it, it's kind of interesting, because he was officially a Marine. And since I was flying with the Marine Corps Reserves at the time, I was considered a civilian at a time when NASA was wanting to show more civilians. For example, Neil Armstrong was the first civilian down there. And so they listed me as a civilian, even though I'm probably to this day the only reservist that maintained my reserve affiliation the entire time I was at NASA. And that was, well, not too easy. I was in a squadron up in Dallas, and sometimes it got to the point where I couldn't get enough flight time in up there. And after a year or two, I ended up transferring to become the air liaison officer with a local infantry battalion right here in Houston. I had also a couple of years where I had to make it all up with paperwork, but I'm glad I maintained that. So when the world ever sits back, takes a look at it, they'll find that the first Marine to go into space was John Glenn. Second Marine to go into space was Walter Cunningham.
Wow.
Yeah. At the same time, if they wanted to think of me as civilians, the first civilian to go into space was Neil Armstrong. And the second, quote, civilian, unquote, to go into space was Walter Cunningham.
You got it both ways.
Yeah.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We'll return to part one of our special tribute to Apollo 12 astronaut Alan Bean and our conversation with his good friend, astronaut Walt Cunningham. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's return to our conversation with one of Alan Bean's best buddies, Apollo 7 astronaut Walt Cunningham. I'd like you to maybe share something with us. Tell us something about Alan Bean that you would know about him as his close friend that other people just wouldn't know. Something about him that you'd like to share with us.
Alan Bean may not have seemed to everybody that unique back in the 1960s, but when Alan passed away, he was, in my opinion, he was the greatest artist to ever come through the space program on that. His paintings were fabulous. He was totally driven by them. He spent full time, all the time, lots of times, day and night, coming up with his pictures or copying photos that had been taken from space, usually around the moon, and he wanted to make sure that he could put that in with the oil painting and with a proper perspective, and even making any of the rocks or the surface look absolutely correct on it. And I will say to this day, Alan, of course he's known as an astronaut, but I think from now on, what Alan really is going to be known as an artist that flew in space, and in my opinion, probably the greatest artist ever.
Did you ever hang out with him while he was painting?
No, I couldn't hang out with Alan when he was painting. And he painted almost continuously, and with whatever equipment he could get to match what he wanted to. And he was so driven by it that, one, he needed the time, and it would drive you crazy if you were watching all of that. But when it got down to the results, you'd look at it and you'd find it just amazing, how accurate the soil was and things like that. But no, you did not hang. I don't know anybody that actually hung out with Alan while he was painting, except maybe his wife.
It was a solitary pursuit.
Yes, driven, really was. He's going to be He's going to be remembered as the greatest painter that was ever in space, believe me.
Is there something, maybe you could leave us with a funny story, something humorous, experience you had with Alan?
I'm just so glad that Alan and I were the best of friends for entire life, that we lived together. As a matter of fact, it must have been 3 or 4 days before he had his stroke up in Indiana, that Alan and I were having our cheeseburger at a local dive, I guess you would call it, but we'd been going there for years, and we were always there for an hour and a half to 2 hours, and talk about whatever was pertinent to us, and sometimes politics, sometimes just painting, family stuff. We were dear close friends, and it's going to be hard for me to get used to that having disappeared.
Well, on that lovely note, I think that's a good place to end it. I want to thank you for your time talking about your dear friend, Alan Bean.
Okay. Can I ask you a question?
Sure, sure.
Yeah. What did you think of the All-American Boys?
Oh, what did I think of? I enjoy it very much. I'm rereading it right now. I'd read it years ago, but I decided to kind of pick it up again, and just learning a lot of things that I'd kind of forgotten about. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I find it interesting how strange the process was of how you got selected as a crew, and how frustrating that had to be for people like you and Al Bean to, you know, just not really know what do you got to do around here, you know, to get on a crew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And nobody even bothers to think about the fact that we were the backup crew for Apollo 1. The other thing that's interesting is I recently reread my book. I wrote it 40 years ago. It took me 4 years to get it in Macmillan and to get it out. And then I didn't do a lot of thinking. Well, come to think of it, right after 2000, I went in and updated it, went through and added some stuff. And recently I reread it, and I can tell you this, the beginning part of that book to me was a whole lot more satisfying than the stuff that I added. I added several chapters because I was talking about the Russians and what have you. And so now I found it really worked to finish the book after I had enjoyed the first part.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, the first part was really interesting to me. Just to try to put myself in your shoes and think, well, you know, all of you are super competitive. You wouldn't have been selected as an astronaut if you weren't a great pilot. You were all perfect for the job, but figuring out how to be just selected, because it was so strange. There was no real method to it other than somehow you got touched by the magic wand of Deke Slayton or Al Shepard, and the, you know, the twists of fate with somebody dying in a plane crash, or of course the Apollo 1 fire that killed the crew. Yeah,
it was a good experience.
Yeah, well, I remember being a kid, and I went to the Kennedy Space Center in 1967 in the summer, right after the fire. And I was only 7, but I was very, very interested in the space program. You know, was picking up on the vibe of what there had been a tragedy there and what had happened. But seeing everything, the giant machinery moving forward, knowing that, you know, this was going to continue. There's just too much, this is too big of a thing for it to stop just because that happened. And then watching your flight, you know, it was covered back then. Those early flights were covered wall to wall by the television networks. And I would get up on the West Coast at, you know, like 3-4 in the morning. And as soon as they would start their coverage, the flight of Apollo 7 brought to you by Gulf Oil. And I would watch that from liftoff to splashdown.
Well, the other thing that's been a big change that people don't think much about, but, you know, Apollo 7 was probably the until that time at least, it was the worst accident that we had had, and because we'd been fighting a lot of schedule stuff and things like that, and stuff that we had wanted to fix that couldn't get changed, operational things like that. But after that Apollo 1 fire, after the Apollo 1 fire, which we were pushing on the speed on that one so we could beat the Russians, and it was not that certain at that time that we were going to be able to do that. But 21 months later, and we had made a little over 1,000 changes in that spacecraft, and we were off flying on a near-perfect machine, turns out. And then after that, you know, you've had the shuttle accident. You had two shuttle accidents, and you look at the accidents themselves and how pretty plain it was what those accidents were. You know, right from immediately, you knew what it was. It took us a while to figure out, actually, in Apollo 1. But I think they fixed a few things in the spacecraft, and the first one was flying again, I want to say, was it 29 months? I can't remember. And then they had the next accident. It was another space shuttle. Fixed whatever they could on that one, and that one was like 33 months after the accident. So our society and our culture has changed in the way we go about fixing these things.
Yeah, the shuttle was a dangerous machine, and if you look at the loss rate per flights, it was definitely a dicey thing to do. Whereas the Apollo spacecraft, you know, of course, it had the one accident on Apollo 13. But, you know, got the crew back, which was amazing. That's another story.
The accident rate, believe me, significantly changed. I think that during Apollo, they looked to lose one of the spacecraft for, I think, in the first 18 or 19 missions, is what we thought at the time. And God only knows what that really would have been. And when they've gotten the space shuttle, they've had numbers as high as 600 and some missions, as low as 80 some missions, what have you. But the fact of the matter is, in my opinion, that shuttle is the greatest flying machine ever built by man to be operated by man. And very few of the people, of the crew type people, had negative feelings about it today. And that's because everybody wasn't a pilot like we used to be. I don't know of a pilot that didn't have a lot of confidence in the shuttle.
And how do you feel about things now that we don't have a routine access to space as the United States? We have to rely on, ironically, the Russians to get to the space station.
Well, we've lost the kind of attitude that it takes to have the commitment. The amount of budget that we have for NASA is trivial compared to what it used to be. I think right now it's they're saying about $4 billion. I think it's down around about 0.4% of the national budget. Now, if you looked at the Apollo, for example, that program was $25 billion. Back in the 1960s, total cost. In today's dollars, if you converted that, you'd be up at around $150 or $160 billion in today's money if you're going to commit to it. So I don't see us really committing to things like that. So we've lost the drive in many ways that it would take.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna let you go and get on with your day and go ahead and, you know, bill us the $10,000. I'll frame that bill on my wall.
No, I wouldn't want to sign something like that.
Thanks to Apollo astronaut Walt Cunningham. Next up, we're going to talk to one of the current members of NASA's Astronaut Corps, Karen Nyberg. She spent 180 days in space as a veteran of STS-124 aboard Space Shuttle Discovery, which made her the 50th woman in space. She also flew on Expedition 3637 to the International Space Station aboard the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. She was also a friend to Alan Bean and joins us from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Karen Nyberg, welcome to Blue Dot.
It's my pleasure being here.
I'd like to know, when did you first meet Alan?
I met him after my long-duration flight. He and I are both, we both had gone to the University of Texas at Austin. And after my long-duration flight in 2013, the UT Alumni Magazine did an article about my flight. And apparently he had read that and he called me. At first, I had a message from my secretary, an email, and said, call Alan Bean. And of course, when I first got that, he's my hero, an astronaut artist. So I was a little starstruck. And then he had left a personal message on my work voicemail and my home voicemail. And so I called him, and we talked for quite a while. It was an awesome conversation just about my flights and his flights. And he talked about how he got into art and I've been interested in art my whole life. So it was just really interesting. And then he invited me and my family to come to his art studio. And then unfortunately life gets in the way and life goes on. And it took a couple years and we never found the perfect time for my family, my husband and my son and I, to all go. And so finally last summer, I just took an opportunity when I had it, and I sent him another note and asked if the invitation was still open. And he said, of course. And so I went to his art studio. It was pretty neat.
Well, you mentioned earlier that, he was your hero. When did you first become aware of him and his significance in the history of spaceflight?
I honestly don't know when I first noticed the artwork that he had been doing. I'd been interested in being an astronaut since I was really young. Of course, that was the shuttle program was just starting, so that was all the rave. I missed in fact, his walk on the moon. I was only a month old, and so the lunar stuff was done by the time I was really getting into it. But I remember seeing his artwork, and art was another thing that was my interest since I was really young. I would never sit in front of the TV without a pad of paper and a pencil and draw. I just loved it so much. So my two passions then were space and art from a young age. But I don't remember when exactly I began to notice his artwork and what he had done.
But it was his artwork that really drew you to him.
Yes, it was his artwork that drew me to him as opposed to some of the other Apollo astronauts.
And tell us what it was like to visit him at the studio. What was that experience like? Could you share a little of that with us?
Yeah, well, I drove up, my first impression, I drive up and he's standing on his driveway. He's wearing his painter's apron that you see a lot in the pictures, and he waves and he smiles. It just so welcoming. He was just so, so welcoming. And, then we went into his studio and he was just so gracious and kind. And I was there about an hour and we talked about a lot of things, and he showed me, some of the latest things he's working on and some of his older things that he worked on. And we talked a lot about getting into art after the astronaut program. I think the thing I noticed most about him is his humility and how gracious he was. I think it's true with him that, truly great individuals don't tell you they're great. They don't need to tell you they're great. It comes through in their words and their actions. And I think that's certainly true with him. And I noticed that more than anything, I think, in that visit with him.
And for our listeners who may not be real familiar with his artwork, I know I am. I own the book that Andy Chaikin wrote in conjunction with him, and they're beautiful paintings. Tell us your impressions of his artwork.
I just think he did. He did such a great job of showing. I like the realistic nature of it. and just showing really what the Apollo missions were about in a lot of different ways. And then also he would incorporate a little bit of moon dust in his art and the impressions of the boots from their spacesuits, and just really personalize it in that way. One of the things that also impressed me with him was realizing when he told me about, after finishing up in the astronaut office and continuing on with his artwork, how hard he worked. He worked so hard. You might have a talent, but it's really the hard work and dedication that puts you above and beyond other people. And he was definitely one of those. He went to galleries and studied other art and practiced and even when I visited, he was working when I, right before I got there, and I stayed an hour, and I think he put a time limit on how long I was there so he could get back to work painting. So just very hardworking.
You didn't watch him paint at all, did you?
No, I didn't.
Uh-uh. Yeah. It seems to be a theme I've heard from a few people that he really liked to do that alone.
My impression would be that as well, from after talking to him, that it's something that he would prefer to be alone to do.
Perhaps his wife might be there, but that was pretty much it from talking to friends, that that was his intensity and his hard work, as you put it, it just was kind of thing where he needed to be totally focused on that. And as I think about it, another impression I get is because he was such a kind and warm person, he wouldn't want to ignore you while you were there. So, I could see that aspect of it too.
Yeah, I could see that as well.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlum. When we come back, we'll finish our conversation with astronaut Karen Nyberg. Thanks for listening. And we're back. Let's resume our visit with astronaut Karen Nyberg as we look back on the life of the late Apollo and Skylab veteran astronaut and artist Alan Bean. How did you become aware that he had passed away?
I had heard that he was sick, and I don't remember exactly when that was, a couple weeks ago perhaps. And then I actually saw a NASA post on Twitter that he had passed on, I guess, last Saturday. It was on social media.
Yeah, that's how I found out too. And it's really kind of it's a gut-wrenching thing when you're kind of going through your Twitter feed to look for fun stuff or whatever, and then you see that.
Yeah, I was sad, very sad. And then I told my son, Alan had signed a book for my son when he was there, and I brought it home, and Jack was very excited, and he said, "Do I get to meet him?" And I said, "Yes, we are going to go back, and you're going to meet him." And we never did. And so then when I told Jack that he had passed away, he was pretty upset as well. He was really hoping to meet him.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Let's talk about the legacy of, I'd like to know, as a current astronaut and somebody who's, flew during the final stages of the space shuttle program, what do the Apollo astronauts in that era mean to the current astronaut corps?
They are the astronauts. They're They blaze the trails. They will always be the heroes, I think. You know, there's now, at least I personally, you know, I don't feel like I've done anything all that special, especially when I compare it to what they've done or what they did. I think they're just always going to be heroes to those of us who are now part of it.
Well, I beg to differ. What you've done is extraordinary. There is that perspective aspect of, you know, they did do those missions to the moon were certainly extraordinary, and the test flights. You know, people don't think about, you know, how important the flights were that preceded Apollo 11, and of course Apollo 12 was, you know, for a lot of people an anticlimax, but to me it was one of the most interesting and wonderful missions.
Yeah, I think that they're all amazing. And yeah. every single space flight we've done, and it, unfortunately they begin to become commonplace. Even though they are all still test flights in a way, you know, it's still all new relatively compared to, you know, other things like aviation where we've been doing it a lot longer. Space flight is still relatively new. But it becomes commonplace in the public eye, which I think is sad.
Well, as you go forward, what are some things that maybe you learned or have been inspired by Alan Bean that you'd like to kind of take forward as you move on in your life?
Well, I, you know, like I said, I've been interested in art my whole life, and it's something that I've been getting into textile arts. I've sewn also my whole life, and I could be in my sewing room all day, every day. I love it that much. And I see similarities in that way that I think I could really get into it. I think what I learned from him is that if I want to be successful in that post-astronaut career, the hard work and dedication that's required is very important. And I think if I choose that path that, I'll be thinking about what he told me as I'm going forward.
Well, Karen, it's been a joy to talk to you about Alan Bean, and thanks for reminiscing with us. Is there anything else you'd like us to know before we leave you?
I feel so fortunate to have had the opportunity to meet him. You know, I only wish that I was able to take my husband and son with me to meet him. But he's just a superhuman being, and I think we're lucky to have had him in the world.
Yeah, you know, that's the one thing that comes through from my own observations of him, which were limited, but, you know, I had some contacts with him. But watching him around people was amazing, as he was just always very generous.
Absolutely. He's an example.
Karen, thanks so much. And what's up for you next in your career as an astronaut? Are you going to be, what does it look like in the near future for you?
Well, the nearest future, my husband is also an astronaut, and he is slated to fly on the test flight for either Boeing or SpaceX coming up. Ooh. Hopefully next year. And so we haven't found out yet which vehicle he will be on, but he will be on one of the test flights. And so he's next to fly. We're kind of take turns since we have a mm-hmm. child. Whether or not I'll fly again, doubtful, but never say never, I guess. I really would like to get more into art, and it's just hard to find the time right now. That's what I'd like to do.
Well, I know that's what Alan did when he left the space program. He just poured himself 110% into his art. And Andy Chaikin told me he like even flew to France to go, because he loved Monet and the Impressionists. And he, you know, walked around the estate there, the Monet estate, and just, you know, immersed himself in that. And it shows in his paintings.
Absolutely. It was impressive when he told me how he had got himself prepared and learned and educated himself and practiced. It's amazing.
Yeah, great lesson for us all. And good luck to you with your future art career. I look forward to seeing some Nyberg originals.
Thanks much. We'll see how it turns out.
I'm sure it'll be wonderful. Thanks to astronaut Karen Nyberg. She joined us via Skype from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Now let's hear from one of the seminal moments in the life and career of Alan Bean as we listen to him call out the descent rates and fuel consumption for Commander Pete Conrad as he was piloting the lunar module Intrepid to a pinpoint landing near the Surveyor 3 robotic spacecraft, which had landed on the moon in 1967 and was the target for their mission to prove that astronauts could land in pinpoint locations. You can also tell what close friends the two are as Bean refers to his commander as Babe.
300 feet coming down at 5.
That's hey,
look at that crater right where it's supposed to be.
Hey, you're beautiful.
10%, 257 feet coming down at 5. 240 coming down at 5. Hey, you're really maneuvering around.
Yeah.
Come on down, Pete.
Okay.
10% fuel. 200 feet, coming down at 3. Need to come on down.
Okay.
190 feet. Come on down, 180 feet. 9%, you're looking good. Get some dust before long. 130 feet, 124 feet, Pete. 120 feet coming down at 6. You got 9%. 8%, you're looking okay. 96 feet coming down at 6. Slow down the descent rate. 80 feet coming down at 4. You're looking good. 70 feet. Looking real good. 63 feet. 60 feet coming down at 3. 50 feet coming down. Watch for the dust. Now, 46.
Low level.
42 feet coming down at 3. Coming down at 2. Okay. Start the clock. 42 feet coming down at 2. 40 coming down at 2. Looking good. Watch for that. 31, 32, 30 feet. Coming down at 2 feet. You got plenty of gas. Plenty of gas, dude. Hang in there.
30 seconds.
18 feet. Coming down at 2. He's got it made. Come on in there. 24 feet. Contact light.
Roger. Copy contact.
Clock. Pro. Yeah, pro. Okay. Make sure I'm off.
Okay.
I'll cycle these valves. You got your 10-inch command override off.
Yep.
Okie dokie. I'll cycle the main shutoff valve.
Okay.
Thought seat closed. We get both rakes closed, babe.
The rakes are closed.
Good landing.
Hey,
outstanding, man.
After automatic.
Beautiful. He sets up. Fire.
Apollo 12 lunar module Intrepid landing on the Ocean of Storms, November 19th, 1969. Al Bean, Pete Conrad, and Dick Gordon, who piloted the command module in lunar orbit, were perhaps the most close-knit of any Apollo crew and remained friends for the rest of their lives. All three are no longer with us, and Bean passed away on May 26, 2018. Let's close the program with a reading from Andrew Chaikin's seminal work from 1994, A Man on the Moon. This is from the chapter titled Sailors on the Ocean of Storms and a profile of a young Alan Bean. From the very beginning, Alan Bean saw the world differently from other test pilots. Long before he ever flew, as a boy in Fort Worth, Texas, he was captivated by the beauty of the airplane in motion. In the summer of 1956, the 24-year-old Bean, thin and bright-eyed, with the well-toned body of a college gymnast, arrived at Jacksonville Naval Air Station. He was the youngest and newest member of Attack Squadron VA-44. In a group photo taken some time afterward, two things about Bean stand out: his ear-to-ear grin and his tie, which is almost the only one that's perfectly straight. Even as a squadron pilot, Bean's sense of aesthetics was very much intact. He longed to fly the best-looking planes, like the sleek F-8U fighter. Unlike the other pilots who spent their free time fixing up old cars, Bean took night classes in oil painting. Bean had always been a loner, but he felt close to the flyers in VA-44. It was a place where everyone had a nickname. There was Dancing Bear and Rocky Pie, Spanky, Dinky, Tiger Jack, and Von Du Quick. Sometimes they called Bean Sarsaparilla because he never touched a drink. Sometimes they just called him Beano. Once on Liberty in Paris, the pilots went drinking and decided to put sarsaparilla to good use. While they drank inside, Bean did gymnastics outside. Before long, he drew a crowd. His squadron mates then came out, one by one, to look for a date. When it came to flying, Bean wasn't a natural, like some of his squadron mates who seemed born to be great aviators. But whatever Bean lacked in innate talent, he made up in effort. Through sheer determination, he mastered the subtleties of precision bombing from a speeding jet and turned himself into one of the best weapons delivery pilots in the squadron. After a 2-year tour at Pax River, Bean felt he'd reached the pinnacle of his profession. And while he shared the other flyers' drive to be the best, he was always aware that his outlook differed from theirs, even after he left Pax River for another attack squadron in Cecil Field, Florida. In 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was talk of sending Bean and his colleagues into combat. The other pilots wanted it, so badly they could taste it. After all, this was what they had been trained for. Bean would have gone in a minute to defend the interests of his country, but he was hardly excited about it. There was no love of combat in his soul, only a love of flying. By that time, Bean had his sights set on a new goal, to become an astronaut. At the suggestion of one of his former instructors from Pax River, he applied for the second selection in 1962. He made it into the final group of 35 pilots, but no further. The instructor, whose name was Pete Conrad, went all the way. The following year, Bean applied again. This time, he made it. Be sure to join us next week for the conclusion of our tribute to astronaut Alan Bean. We'll hear from Apollo 9 Lunar Module pilot Rusty Schweikart and Andrew Chaikin, author of A Man on the Moon and a close friend of Alan Bean's. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org and subscribe. Blue Dot at NPR Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is produced and engineered by the man on the board, Nolan Ford, and it's distributed nationally through PRX. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot. And Godspeed, Bino.